Do you make a big breakfast on Sunday? Do you wonder what else is possible? Are your fellow diners, otherwise known as your family, too finicky to appreciate any divergence? If you like Sunday brunch and wonder what else is there to make, then I might have an idea or two for you. It's a Sunday brunch episode, and the only limits sit at the table with you. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 224, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello folks, Dan Reid here. If you cook meats or make bread or pastry, you need to know what is the temperature of your food. Chefs' temp thermometers are digital and instant reads, so you know exactly what the temperature is. And for you smokers, they have multi-probe thermometers with Bluetooth, so you can watch the game and keep an eye on the brisket. Check out the selection at culinarylibertarian.com/cheftemp or click the link on the show notes page. Sunday brunch at the Ritz-Carlton Naples was one heck of a display. Every week there were platters of fruit and meat and cheese and pâtés and croissants and rolls and Danish and pastries. Now, that wasn't all in one. They were everywhere, just giant mirrors. It was just it was quite a thing. There was they had ice carving and pretzel dough cornucopia overflowing with bounty. At Easter time, somebody would make any holiday. I remember there either some salt dough or sometimes with chocolate, some big displays appropriate for whatever was the theme. The main dining room, creatively called the dining room, served four hot plate choices, with one choice always being Eggs Benedict. Now, I started as a cook in the dining room at that Ritz and ended up running Sunday brunch. We always had to keep the eggs benny, but there was plenty of opportunity to experiment, for me as a cook, with those other three plates. Now, that's a whole other story, and that's a different show. I do Sunday brunch at home, but substantially more restrained. It's always eggs, scrambled, to please everyone else. I'm a big fan of poached eggs. Bacon and sausage, usually link sausage, but sometimes patties, and a carb. Now, those carbs are always gluten-free, and mostly they're a version of a pancake. Sometimes it's an almond keto pancake, which is pretty well-liked, but one daughter prefers the fluffy pancakes more. Once in a while, it's a waffle, which is much appreciated for the infrequency. Rare, but more frequent than waffles, is French toast, usually with a cinnamon twist style bread that we bought. More rare than waffles is a full size, that is, a 10-inch cast iron pan-sized hash brown cut into wedges. Now, I have been making some version of a hashed brown thing for years, and I've always liked them, but they always seemed to be missing something. The goal was to try to get to, well, frankly, those McDonald's hash brown patties. Now, I've mostly figured out how to do that. And there is actually a thing to it. Now, when you make it big, it changes. But I've gotten close to what I envision in my head. And that's, for a cook, that's probably the biggest satisfaction there can be. When you make the thing you see in your head, it's time to go home. Now, those who eat it can't really tell the difference, but I know there is one. Added to that list of made but almost never are crepes and sausage and biscuits, well, sausage gravy and biscuits. The kids are less thrilled about that one than I am, and especially my wife, being Southern. So that turns out maybe to be a Saturday thing or a rare breakfast for dinner thing, which is fine because it means more for me, more for us, and gives them some option of something else. By comparison to that Ritz brunch, Sunday here is just a big breakfast. I would do poached eggs, but as I mentioned, no one likes them. No one likes the runny yolks, and hard poached eggs seems a food sin of great magnitude, and I dare not venture there. There doesn't seem to be a minimum requirement for brunch. I probably come close with eggs, some griddled, carby bread thing, two pork products, and coffee. If I had the audience, I would do more variety more often, but the audience I have is perfectly fine with the things we have. Part of the brunch success lies in planning. Shopping before Sunday for the ingredients for pancakes prevents that oh crap moment, which means an instant change of plans, or some version of pancake alchemy, which may or may not work, and it may work spectacularly, and it may also fail the same way. Perhaps the most challenging part of brunch cooking is timing, planning everything to be done mostly at the same time. Now, to get there, I lay my bacon on a screen, well, like a cooling rack of the same size as the pan. Officially, it's a half sheet pan. And I bake it, which frees up the stove top and allows the bacon to cook and remain flat and gathers all the grease for collection, which I use throughout the week for various cooking things. I griddle the pancakes instead of cooking them in a pan. Again, frees up the stovetop. Plus, I can all get eight on the griddle at one time. The stovetop is busy with the sausage links and then with the eggs. The kids don't care for the sausage bits in scrambled eggs, which I would prefer, since it's one fewer pan to clean, and that sausage bit flavor in the eggs, I find it appealing. And yes, that does go against Escoffier's method for scrambled eggs, and I'm okay with that. Listen to episode 218 for the Escoffier Egg Cookery Show. The sausage is in... No, the sausage is on the stove and the bacon is finishing in the stove, in the oven. That can get crowded if you aren't used to more than one thing happening at a time. It can also get kind of hot. I use a mason jar, put in the back left corner to pour the bacon fat into. When the bacon is done, I lift it off that screen with a pair of forceps. I have large... They look like surgical implements, but the design that they might be, that I use them in the kitchen. I lift the bacon off of those, and then I put it onto the left. I have that nearly useless piece of counter space that, for some reason, every kitchen design seems to have, this useless strip of real estate in the kitchen. Well, mine's wide enough that it will hold a paper towel for the bacon, but I have a tip. I save all my produce bags and I save the bread bags. Produce bags, depending on how it is, if it's gathered at the bottom, I cut the gather off. If it's just regular, I cut it in half. I make two halves of that produce bag. And then in the space provided on my useless piece of real estate, which now becomes useful, fold the bag over so it's not melting on the burner, put paper towel on top of it. That's where I place the cooked bacon. Now, I've done all that well before the bacon goes in the oven, so it's ready for me when I'm ready for it. And then the pan. Now, the bacon fat's in the mason jar. The bacon's on the piece of paper, which is on the piece of plastic. Now, got a hot pan. In anticipation of having a hot pan, make sure you have some place on your counter, if it's going to melt, make sure you have a cooling rack on someplace on your counter for that hot pan, and make sure you let the people know that when they come in the kitchen, don't touch the pan. You can't see that it's hot, but you'll find out quick. So I push mine all the way to the back, next to the backsplash, so that, one, people know not to touch it, but in case someone gets too close, they don't touch it anyway. And it cools fast. But safety is important, because you don't want to complicate Sunday brunch with a burn. The beauty of that little piece of plastic with paper towel is once the bacon, and once brunch is done, we've eaten our bacon, and there's leftover bacon. I know. What the heck is leftover bacon? I put that in a bag and in the cooler for sandwiches or for breakfast tomorrow. Roll up that plastic paper towel and pew, in the garbage. Now the counter's clean. The advantage of all that is not having to clean greasy counter. And reduce, reuse, recycle, right? The part of the bacon grease that didn't go into the mason jar is still on that pan. So one of the reasons to leave the pan on the counter and not putting into the sink itself is management of grease. Grease in a drain is bad news all the time. At some point, it's going to catch up to you. So when that bacon fat is cool, I use a rubber scraper and scrape up as much as I can and then divide that inequally between the dog's food dishes. It's unequal because one dog is four times the size of the other one, so he gets more bacon fat. And then maybe paper towel the pan, just because we've had drain issues here. This is boring information, but we've had drain issues here, and so adding to that is not something I'm interested in doing. Almost any version of pancake is made better with amendments. Chocolate chips for blueberries are the two most popular amendments here. Raspberries in the spring are very popular because they're fresh. There is a chocolate company, Vosges, V-O-S-G-E-S. I'm not an affiliate, but they make both, I think, milk and dark chocolate bar with crumbled bits of bacon in the chocolate bar. And so we get that for special occasions and break it into small bits and put that instead of chocolate chips as the amendment to the pancakes. And bacon and chocolate is really good together. And if that sounds weird to you, I'm not sure that I can convince you that it's worth trying, except it is worth trying. That company does a spectacular job, and it's always a treat to get that chocolate in pancakes. It's worth doing. So, what is possible for you depends on space, ability, willingness, and the audience. We like biscuits, and the girls like biscuits, so they show up in our repertoire once in a while, and our repertoire means me in the royal hour sense, because I'm the one that does the cooking. Bannocks is a form of biscuit which is griddled and not baked, and there's probably a fairly interesting history to that, but I think it's probably starts and ends with the need to have something hot on a flat top because you didn't have an oven. So I'm thinking, out west, Oregon Trail, cowboys, whatever, wagon train kinds of things. They had heat and they had cast iron. They just didn't have an oven. So they probably figured that out. I like them. They're kind of fun to make and they're really fun to watch. And they have the outside crispy, crunchy part. Man, that's really good. Crunchy on the outside, soft and buttery inside. Those are worth making. And they look, as far as procedure goes, they look like biscuits. They're just cooked differently. So the possibility is vast. Starting at the top, you could have caviar with all the fixins, which means, red onions and blini and sour cream, and you could just go all out. A bit more in budget would be scrambled eggs with chives or tarragon. Cream cheese kind of melts nicely in there in small bits. And, you know, even in kind of big, cut them in small, even when it doesn't melt all the way, it's kind of a nice, I like biting into that. It's kind of a fun change of pace and the texture of the egg. Breakfast meats we've covered, but you can go nuts with that. So there's bacon and there's sausage. And if you live in the right part of the world, there's Taylor ham. Pork roll, yeah, I heard you. Canadian bacon, or you can do pineapple pizza, yeah. Pretty much, I mean, if you had leftover asabuco, I don't really see why that couldn't be part of Sunday brunch. Might actually be kind of good. So there's just go nuts with that. And then fruit or cheese trays, or charcuterie board, or cinnamon rolls, or Danish, or croissants, or all three. Now, here is a place where planning is going to make life easy. If you buy the croissants, follow the package instructions for whatever it is to say to thaw, bake, who knows what they do. If you make them, proof them in the oven, turned off oven, overnight. Remove them in the morning, delicately. Turn the oven on, egg wash the croissants, and when the oven is at the right temperature, 375 ought to do it, bake them till done. Danish and cinnamon rolls can be made early in the week and frozen for later. Now, they have to be portioned. They have to be nearly finished. If you're making Danish snails, that's pretty easy to freeze. For cinnamon rolls, I put them in the pan that they're going to be baked in. Freeze that pan with the cinnamon rolls all in one shot. Wrap it into one of those produce bags that I didn't cut in half. It is a perfect thing to wrap that pan in. So it helps just keep the moisture inside a little bit. So there's a couple ways to go with this. Pull them out of the freezer on Saturday night and leave them in the bag on the counter overnight. So they thaw and proof, and turn the oven on, 350, when it's done, take them out of the bag, bake them till they're done, and glaze them. You could also take them out Friday night, put them in the cooler, in the bag, overnight, and on Saturday night, before you go to bed, put them on the counter, in the bag, let them proof. Same thing. I don't know that one day in the cooler is going to make much of a difference. It might. They might proof a little bit better because it's had an extra day of fermenting. But either way, it's an easy thing to do. It certainly beats getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to make cinnamon rolls. I do want to add this observation, this comment, that the cinnamon rolls and the Danish that I'm talking about are gluten-y. I've not tried freezing, thawing, and baking gluten-free doughs, so I can't speak to that. Because most gluten-free doughs don't take yeast, they seem more the mix and shape and bake thing. But there are some exceptional gluten-free websites. The Loopy Whisk is one of them, and she might have more information than I do. She's bound to, because this is her niche. For the toppings on those carby things, if syrups aren't interesting to you, but fruit topping is, make a compote. If you were watching the Great British Bake Off, they might say compote, which I think is a stupid way to say it. Berries and or orange segments and or bananas or any combination of fruits that you like. Add some sugar or a suitable to you sugar substitute and let the fruit and sugar macerate for a few hours. Add a pinch of salt to that too. The salt will help draw the water out and enhance the flavor and what the sugar is doing. And to some degree, I think I'm mostly right about this, but there's a lot that I don't know about sugar substitutes. And so I might be incorrect about this. But what the sugar does is draws the water out of the fruit. And so you get pigment from the fruit. Say you're doing strawberries and blackberries. You're going to get pigment drawn out when the sugar pulls the water out. But what it's leaving behind is the sugar in the fruit, so it's going to enhance the flavor. salt does that a little bit too. But it creates this just kind of a slightly different thing. It doesn't need to be cooked. So that can be scooped on top of your French toast or waffles or pancakes or whatever you have. Eat it by itself. Put it on yogurt. There's just, you know, it has a lot of ways it can be used. In the springtime, when the mint comes in, a shift out of mint inside of that is quite nice. And there's just a nice springy mint feel. I like springy mint feel. Looking forward to it. If griddled things or waffle iron things aren't of particular interest, or you want to change it up, muffins. It's the same mixing procedure as pancakes. And they also have scores of options. Now, the other thing is, you can take a basic muffin batter, you can add cocoa to it, you'll have to add more buttermilk or milk to that particular batter, because cocoa is very, very thirsty, will take up whatever available water is there. So it needs to be, need more liquid to it to loosen it back up so that it actually will rise. If the muffin batter is too stiff, you're going to make hockey pucks, and nobody wants hockey pucks unless, you know, you're playing hockey. The gluten-free versions of muffins are pretty much easy to do too. The big challenge I've talked about before with gluten-free is flours are not interchangeable. And you're not, even the mixes, they're not, sometimes you'll get lucky, but there's a lot of choice out there. It's not like going from gold medal or gold label to, I guess that's beer, gold medal flour to King Arthur flour to, I'm sure there's something else I'm missing, but that's mostly the same. You're going to get pretty predictable results bag to bag. With gluten-free mixes, that's much different. So if you do a mix, follow the package instructions for making a muffin, but it isn't hard to do, and they're fun to eat, and, you know, throw chocolate chips and pecans in there. The one thing I will make an observation about is gluten-free muffins. Gluten-free baked goods mostly seem to dry out faster than their gluten-y counterparts. And that might really be what I might be saying actually is I think they stale faster, which could be the case. I don't actually, this is an interesting idea I've never even pursued, but it's at least seems to be the case based on my observations here baking the stuff. Some of you who listen may say, hey, Danny boy, that's a lot of carbs. Yes. Yes, it is. I eat one pancake or one slice of French toast, and usually without syrup, unless it's really spectacular maple syrup, and then how do you not? I've managed to get myself to a place through restricting a lot of the carbs where if I eat them, they will do what carbs do. In fact, insulin will increase in production when you eat. You eat a stick of butter, your insulin is going to increase in production. Maybe not to the same extent as if you eat four pancakes, but insulin goes up when you eat. The big difference with me compared to someone who hasn't weaned off of that is I don't have the crash and I don't have the other kinds of things that happen after I eat a pancake. And if I do the keto ones, I eat two. Now, sometimes on brunch, we do like mimosas, especially on holiday mornings, but not for our normal Sunday brunch. We do still have to function. And if you say, what is a mimosa? Yeah. Well, I kind of get a little heavy with the champagne, because why not? It's champagne. Mostly, it's champagne garnished with orange juice. That's my version of a mimosa. So, I hope this brunch episode gives you some ideas, at least about what could be possible for your next big breakfast. Timing helps get everything on the table, mostly at the same time. Eggs are always cooked last, so they're as hot as possible, and they don't really hold heat particularly well. And anything done too soon can be held in the 250-degree oven while it waits for everything else, including the eggs. So your pancakes or waffles or French toast, muffins probably don't need to be held in the oven. Bannocks can be held on the griddle. But trying to get everything ready at the same time or close to that's a good goal. It's okay. Plan what's going to be cooked so you know where you're going to be and be ready with a vision of your execution of that plan. What needs to be done first? What can wait? Baking can sit on the counter. It doesn't have to be the last thing done. Where will those things be when they're done? And where will the pans go when they're done? Extra meats or pancakes or waffles or what have you is just an easy breakfast for the next day. It's not a failure. It's actually make extra on purpose so breakfast is easy the next couple of days. Or possibly a lunch. Now, the only exception would be reheating eggs. They're not really that great. We are four people and I cook six eggs, and the dogs rarely get egg leftovers. Speaking of leftovers, I made the long ago promised fondant cake for my oldest's 16th birthday. Now, I promised that 10 or more years ago, and 16 seemed far enough away at the time that it bought me a few years. Well, she didn't forget. Maybe that was my hope. So anyway, I did it. Red velvet cake with cream cheese icing and marshmallow fondant. Sky blue, please. I didn't make the marshmallows for the fondant, but I made everything else. Well, I didn't make the cream cheese, but I did make everything else from scratch. It's been a long time since I made red velvet cake, and I remembered a few things. I'm going to do a chef's table about that adventure, which really wasn't an adventure. It was just baking a cake I haven't made in a while. And in case you are looking ahead, I have made no promises for more cakes for any future events. Also, she hasn't asked. All right, folks, that's going to do it. One thing I want to share with you. I have accepted a contract to write a book along the lines of 50 Things to Know About Being a Chef. The two books I wrote, I published through Amazon. This one, I am not publishing through Amazon, so it's going to be some more delay to it. Now, I don't know much more than I'm writing this book, but I'll keep you updated as there are updates to share. Right now, the main task is the writing and also finding the last 20 or so questions to ask and then to answer. I'm excited about this. This is kind of fun. It gets me thinking about some of the things I probably wondered when I was a kid. And some of the things I think I might have been asked when I was working. But this is going to be, I'm going to enjoy. This is going to be cool. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you being here. Thanks also to my Patreon supporters. As mentioned, the chef's table portion is up. It's about baking and making marshmallow fondant. You can find the link to become a patron on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/224. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.